Tonight on Arena, Ruth Gilligan brings us to 1996 and the BSE crisis in her new novel, The Butchers. And happy 250th birthday, William Wordsworth. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Butchers is set in the Irish borderlands in 1996 during the BSE crisis. The book begins with a description of a photograph from that time of, quote, a man hanging from the ceiling upside down in a coal store dangling from a hook that pierces his feet. That man is a member of a group of ritual cattle slaughterers known as the Butchers. But how did he get strung up there in a meat cauldron? Well, I'm pretty certain my next guest, Ruth Gilligan, the author of the best-selling Nine Folds Make a Paper Swan, and now the Butchers, will be able to fill me in on the background to these characters. It's a pretty grisling start to the Butchers, Ruth. Where did this idea of a group of ritual animal slaughterers roaming the border counties in Ireland, where did it come from?
Well, yeah, I mean, God knows how my brain works, right? But I was really interested, first and foremost, in writing a novel that was set in 1996, as you said, during the BSE crisis. And it was a period, you know, that I lived through. I was 8 years old in 1996, so I remember it. But mostly I just remember, you know, not eating burgers for a while, and that was about it. But I was talking to a friend of mine whose father's a farmer, and he was kind of giving me some stories about what it had been really like at the time, especially for men involved in cattle and the beef industry more generally. I was like, wow, there's a whole side to this story that I don't know about. So I went away and started doing some research, and I decided, yes, this was kind of good fodder for the new book. But as well as kind of exploring the real life events of 1996 and the cattle and the beef industry and the toll that the BSE crisis took, I was also really interested in exploring, you know, 1996 was a really interesting point in Irish history. Like, it's, you know, the year that divorce legislation has been brought in. It's only 3 years since homosexuality has been decriminalised. So, you know, in many ways, Ireland is still kind of catching up in terms of being kind of a modern country. But at the same time, you've got kind of the beginnings of the Celtic Tiger beginning to rumble. You've got the tail end of, you know, the Troubles is just coming to an end. So it's this kind of hinge moment between, you know, old-fashioned Ireland and modern, future-looking Ireland. So I was interested in exploring, you know, as I said, the real-life events that were going on, but also, you know, Irish kind of tradition and folklore and superstition, how so many people did, and frankly still do, kind of cling to some of those things. So because I was preoccupied with cows, I started reading books and marking down all the little traditions and rituals and superstitions we have around cattle in our country. And I kind of hodgepodged all of those together and came up with this slightly nuts group called The Butchers.
There's a whole other side to 1996 that I thought you might mention in the midst of your list of important events. Those of us who were involved in the acting fraternity at the time will remember the furore that the gay kiss on Fair City in 1996 caused between Peter Warnock, the actor Peter Warnock, and the actor Alan Smith, playing Liam and Owen, respectively. What age were you when you first became involved in Fair City?
Well, I will say that the gay kiss, although I believe it was an almost kiss, I think they got interrupted just as their lips were about to meet, and that very much does feature in the novel. I was in Fair City really a very long time ago now. I was in it just for 4 years between the age of 12 and 16, so I finished up in 2004, which is truly a long time ago, but it is still absolutely remarkable how to this day people still recognize me from the show. I was in Ennis only a few weeks ago, back before we were all on lockdown. I was there for the book club festival, and yeah, people were stopping me in the street going, oh, you're the girl from Fair City. So I cannot quite believe that 16 years later, my face still brings back those happy memories.
And the fact that you include a reference to Fair City in this new book kind of betrays to me that there's a large love for the series in some ways still, is there?
Yeah, of course. I mean, they were very, very happy, happy years, and I look back on it with much fondness. Part of the fun, to be honest, of setting a book in 1996, and it starts in January and ends in December, was going back and remembering all of the kind of pop culture or major events that took place that year. So, you know, between the First City Kiss, but also, you know, you've got the Euro football tournament, you've got Veronica Guerin's murder, you've got Michelle Smith at the Olympics. So all these things, you've got the Spice Girls coming out for the first time. So it was really fun to kind of pepper the novel with these references to kind of late 90s culture, because, as I said, I was there. I remember all of it, but it was a lovely kind of trip down memory lane to include them all again.
The butchers then of the title group of the new novel, eight men we're talking about here, who travel around Ireland for 11 months at a time. Actually, they only come home for 1 month in the midst of it all. Is there an origin in folklore around this type of ritualistic killing? Maybe not precisely as you describe it, but something that sent you off to imagine what you describe in the book.
Absolutely, yeah. And all the kind of rituals that the butchers enact, whether that's facing a certain way when they, you know, kill cattle, whether it's burning certain herbs under a cow's nose, whether it's tying a knot in its tail for good luck, all these things, as I said, I went back through books and books and endless archives of old Irish folklore and found all these little traditions to do with cattle, and then kind of stuck them all together and came up with the butchers. And it's funny because my editor, who, you know, is British, my publisher is based over here in London, he thought for a really very, very long time that the butchers were real. It was only towards the end of the editorial process that we were trying to figure out just this one sticking point in the novel we couldn't quite get right. And I said, well, look, James, I could just change this aspect of the butchers and then everything will fall into place. And he said, well, you can't do that. You can't just change. You can't just make things up. And I was like, whoa, you definitely haven't realized that this is a fabrication. But, you know, obviously, because he's English, he just thought, oh, it's some Irish tradition that I haven't heard of. But it's funny because, as I said, so much of what they do and the actual, rituals that they enact have been borrowed from these various books and archives I found. So it's quite an interesting thing to talk about what's true and what's not, and what's made up and what's not, because the line between myth and legend and truth is a pretty fine one at the best of times.
Well, is the curse of the farmer's widow real or imagined?
Well, that would be telling. Most of it is a fabrication of mine. So, but again, I'm really interested in this idea of whether it matters and whether, you know, these, you know, different people set different stock by different legends and superstitions. So it's funny when people are really want to pin down what's true and what's not, because I'm very happy for people to make their own minds up.
Well, according to your book, The Curse of the Farmer's Widow is about a woman, and war had claimed all eight of her men, sons and husband, etc., etc. So she decreed henceforth that no man could slaughter alone. Instead, seven others had to be by his side to stop the memory of her grief from dying. Real echoes there for me of the pangs of Ulster and the Tán Bóchúlainn, obviously, when we're talking about cows and beef as well. What role did Irish mythology specifically, you know, those older stories, you have a character called Fionn as well. What role did those older stories play?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Fionn, and his surname, he's a Fionn Mac, so I was definitely giving a nod to the old mythology. Don't worry, I'm definitely having lots of fun of that, and the Tán, you know, plays a role as well. And especially, I should add, because a lot of the novel is set in the border counties, and because one of the kind of effects of the BSE crisis in 1996 had on Ireland was that because British beef was outlawed, and obviously that included Northern Irish beef, but obviously beef in the Republic was still fine. So what ended up happening, I discovered, was that a lot of steaks and then ultimately cattle ended up getting smuggled over the border. So this idea of cattle smuggling and all of that, as you say, absolutely harks back to the Tán Bóchúlainn and that whole kind of mythological cycle. So this was just another way that I was finding all these resonances between real life, modern Ireland and ancient mythological Ireland. And I just had great fun kind of matching all that up.
And I suppose the other side of that is what you're really looking at here is just how political cattle can be, I suppose, because of their economic value.
Yes, absolutely. And the politics of it all, as I said, was something that I was pretty ignorant of because, as I said, I was only 8 at the time. But I think going back into it and doing all my kind of my homework and reading my books about that period, yes, I hadn't quite appreciated how bound up cows were in the political psyche of the country. So it was really interesting to see how that played out. And also, you know, as I mentioned, because it's 2 years before the Good Friday Agreement, the idea that the border is becoming a site of cattle and steak smuggling, you know, bear in mind the troubles are still, you know, not quite finished. There's still some violence that year. So, you know, it's funny to think that the border, just when things are calming down and peace is on its way, that it's getting just disrupted all over again, but in a very different way. So I think, yeah, the political aspect is absolutely there in a number of different ways.
Given that we've mentioned the Fair City background previous to this, what about the writing of dialogue when it comes to writing prose? Do the old acting juices get excited when you go to do that? Because I know you teach this as well.
Yeah, I do. I teach creative writing. So I love writing dialogue. I you know, it's something that I know some people find hard, and God knows there are plenty of things that I find hard in the writing process. But dialogue is one thing that I have loads of fun doing. I read everything out loud. I think my neighbours must think I'm crazy because I spend all day kind of talking to myself, but it's because I'm reading everything out loud to make sure it sounds absolutely correct. To be honest, my prose, apparently, I've been told sometimes, sounds like the way that I chat along as well. So yeah, it's a very oral thing. And funnily enough, actually, The Butchers is the first of my novels where I've had an audiobook deal. So that was very fun to, you know, I can now listen to an actor reading my book and hearing it aloud is such a joy. So yeah, I have great fun with the dialogue and making my characters kind of come to life in that way. So yeah, it's something I definitely try and impart on my students as well.
And finally then, Ruth, you know, the BSE, the whole our mad cow disease, as it was referred to at the time, very important theme in the novel, and all sorts of, you mean, at that time, you said you weren't eating burgers, that's what you remember about it at the age of 8, but there were all sorts of, you know, clamps down on the moving of animals around the place at the time, which is part of the book as well. Do you see any parallels between that and our current situation?
Absolutely. I mean, look, the timing is a bit mad because, you know, for most of the duration when I was researching and writing this novel, I would tell people what I was working on and they would say, wow, a novel set, you know, along the border and to do with the transport of goods and stuff. Wow, you know, given all the Brexit stuff, that's very topical, isn't it? And, you know, in many ways, I thought that would be the conversation that I'd be having when the novel came out. And then, lo and behold, we find ourselves in the current situation and there's a whole other set of kind of echoes and resonances. So, yeah, I do think the novel is timely in that way, particularly about, you know, as you mentioned, some of the practical implications. But for me, the most interesting thing has been, you know, when I was researching the novel, I read this wonderful book called Scared to Death, which analysed the BSE crisis, but also SARS and bird flu and these other pandemics, and talking specifically about the way the media, the role they played in terms of, you know, stoking fear or calm or, you know, playing to the scientists or not listening to the scientists and feeding the public different bits of information. So it's been really interesting having thought about that at length vis-a-vis the mad cow disease, how, you know, watching how that's playing out at the moment with regard to COVID.
All right, that's Ruth Gilligan speaking to me about her current novel, The Butchers, which is published by Atlantic. It was announced earlier today that the legendary American singer-songwriter John Prine had succumbed to the COVID-19 virus. Obviously, extremely sad news for his family, his in-laws in Donegal, and his fans in the wider music community. The community includes contemporaries like Bruce Springsteen, who tweeted earlier today, "Over here on East Street, we are crushed by the loss of John Prine. John and I were the new Dylans together in the early 1970s, and he was never anything but the loveliest guy in the world. True national treasure, songwriter for the ages. We send our love and prayers to his family." John Prine was 73 years old. His first album, released back in 1971, kicked off a music career that would last half a century. That career was rewarded in January of this year with a Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award. On St. Patrick's Day, on our special programme here, in fact, we looked back at 1990, and one of our guests on that night, Lise Hand, recalled an encounter she had with John Prine in that memorable year. Let's have a listen to that story.
And I was actually in the Dockers Bar, which was a very famous bar down, long gone now, down on John Rogerson's Quay. It was U2's bar, and it was right beside Wilma Lane Studio, so it was always full of musicians. It was a 4 o'clock kickoff. I bunked off work early, went and nabbed a whole pile of seats, and we were watching it with all the boys from Something Happens and a big rock gang. I was there first. Next thing, the door opens, and this guy wanders in with a suitcase and a guitar, looking a bit lost. And there was flags and then green everywhere, and everybody, like, everybody was in green. And so he went up to the bar and ordered a pint, and he was clearly on his own. And he said, "What's going on here?" And I went, "You're John Prine." And he went, "Yes, I am." I said, "Get your pint, come over and join us, and I'll explain what this game is." Because he had no idea, he had never seen a football game in his life. So cue about 3 hours later, and he's standing on a stool with about four women buried in his jumper going, "I can't look, John, just tell us what's going on." And he actually was commentating John Prine, who had never seen anything, you know, up to that point, a football match. And as the crowds went out onto the street, he turned to one of us and went, "This is a great game, are they always like that?"
There we go, Lee's Hand recalling an encounter there with singer-songwriter John Prine in 1990. And as I was saying, we heard today, sad news broke of his death. Obviously, our thoughts and best wishes go to his wife, Fiona Whelan Prine, and all of his family. Last week, when we heard the news of his illness, we played a duet he recorded with Maria Doyle Kennedy in 2012 to send our best wishes. Let's take another song from John Prine now to mark his memory from his 1984 album, Aimless Love. This is called Only Love.
Nothing else, you see, there's nothing else. Only love, only love.
Only love from John Prine, whose death was announced earlier today. And that has whetted mine, and I'm sure your appetite to hear more John Prine, and you'll get a wonderful opportunity to do so straight after this programme. In fact, John Creedon will be giving us a special programme on John Prine, including many live recordings. And that's coming up at 8 o'clock, straight after us here on RTE Radio 1. Yesterday marked the 250th anniversary of the birth of the English poet William Wordsworth. Now he is at the very heart of the poetry establishment, perhaps even something of an institution himself. So it's easy to forget the young poet's radicalism, his passion for the French Revolution, to begin with at any rate, and how he changed the way we view nature, childhood and the self. Radical Wordsworth, the poet who changed the world, is a new biography by Jonathan Bate. Dara Downs has been reading it for us, and he joins me now on the line. Let's start with, I know I'm talking to a big fan when I talk to you about William Wordsworth, Dara, but why does Wordsworth matter?
I think his poems, they're not period pieces, Sean. For many years, he would be anthologized, you know, for decades. And he got a bit of an image as a twee poet, a poet of the picturesque and the pretty. He's actually a poet who's trying to take us back to first principles. He's asking deceptively simple questions about, you know, what is nature, what is the self, what is memory, how does it work, what is society, what might a benevolent society look like, and also, what does the child have to teach us about the adult?
You know, I suppose for most people, when you hear the name Wordsworth, you probably go back, I think it was, and show my age now, an insert poem that all of us learned or somewhere along the line, "I wandered lonely as a cloud," etc., etc. You know, has the daffodils, has that done him more harm than good because of that, you know, it being part of so many school syllabuses and maybe slightly twee, as you referred to there in your last comments?
I absolutely. But the ironic thing is that poem is as radical as anything Wordsworth wrote from a poetic perspective. It's not actually a poem about daffodils blowing in the breeze so much as a poem about this mysterious thing that happens well after that the poet has seen those daffodils, when he's, you know, lying on a couch and the image of the daffodils flashes unbidden in his mind's eye, and his heart starts racing in sync with the daffodils. It's more about the psychology of experience than just seeing daffodils. But it was you know, embroidered into so many tea towels in the Lake District, and you know, this became the iconic Wordsworth for such a long time. But the poem itself is deeply Wordsworthian.
And what is that radicalism then? And how does Jonathan Bate describe it in this book we're talking about?
Well, Bate, I think he does a great job of showing that there is political radicalism in there, but radicalism comes in different forms. It's the almost primitive inquiry which Wordsworth brings. He's asking himself the question, after what he sees as the failure of the French Revolution, he's saying, who are we? How do our minds work? How can we possibly think we can build a better society if human beings can behave the way we've just seen them behave in the Reign of Terror in Paris? So he's trying to, as I say, go back to the very, very first principles.
To where then does Tintern Abbey fit into those that return to first principles? We refer to it as Tintern Abbey, obviously a much longer title than that, but to give it its full title, if we want to do that, where does it fit into the radical story?
It's a poem of tempered radicalism. Wordsworth, with his sister Dorothy, he's revisiting this place by the banks of the Wye. The Tintern Abbey itself doesn't actually feature in the poem. It's amusing. But he's asking, how have I changed from the last time I was here 5 years ago? And he's trying to tease out the effects of time on the self, and he's trying to enter into a kind of a dialogue with his earlier self or earlier selves. And he's trying to find a principle that could become the foundation for a truly just and kind and benevolent society. And he's trying to find that in nature. There's a line in the poem that nature never did betray the heart that loved her. The word betray is important there. And Bate brings this out really quite brilliantly. Wordsworth was just traumatized by all the betrayal that had happened, the betrayal of the dream of the French Revolution, the betrayal of human beings by one another, seemingly progressive human beings denouncing one another and so forth. And he's asking, can we at least trust nature? That's what part of what's going on in that wonderful poem.
Well, we listen to a little section of it, and I will give it its full title. Andrew Motion is the reader here, and he's reading from Lines Composed a Few Miles Above Tintern Abbey on Revisiting the Banks of the Wye During a Tour, July the 13th, 1798.
These beauteous forms, through a long absence, have not been to me as is a landscape to a blind man's eye, but oft in lonely rooms and mid the din of towns and cities, I have owed to them, in hours of weariness, sensations sweet, felt in the blood, and felt along the heart. And passing even into my purer mind with tranquil restoration, feelings too of unremembered pleasure, such perhaps as have no slight or trivial influence on that best portion of a good man's life, his little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Nor less, I trust, to them I may have owed another gift of aspect more sublime, that blessed mood in which the burden of the mystery, in which the heavy and the weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lightened, that serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on, until the breath of this corporeal frame and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul, while, with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things.
And that's Andrew Motion reading from Tintern Abbey, the Wordsworth poem. Yesterday, the 250th anniversary of Wordsworth's birth, and the book Radical Wordsworth, The Poet Who Changed the Word, is a new biography from Jonathan Bate. Dara Dan's speaking to me about Wordsworth and that book this evening. That poem gives us a sense of that. We're not just talking about a nature poet here, we're talking about a political poet in many ways here, Dara. And what Bate does is, it's a very long life in terms of Wordsworth. How does Bate, you know, cover the span of that hugely long poetic career?
Oh, he quite unapologetically says, I'm not going to give equal time to the latter part of Wordsworth's career. He wants this to be a not over long and not over specialised books, as he says himself. His attitude, and this has been the critical consensus for years now. The first half of Wordsworth's life, these are his words, was such an extraordinary adventure, and somehow the second half was so dull. Wordsworth lived to the grand old age of 80, and he by most accounts, got duller and duller and duller, and his poetic muse seems to have deserted him.
How important was Dorothy Wordsworth in all of William Wordsworth's his work, his ideas?
Oh, she was of crucial importance. I mean, she's with him when he's having the experiences described in Tintern Abbey. She's addressed directly in the poem. But it's more than that. She kept a journal, and scholars have been finding all sorts of resonances between what's in the journals and what's in Wordsworth's own poems. She had a massive influence. She seems not to have wanted to be a published author herself, but there have been some complaints that Wordsworth didn't give her the full credit. Now, they were absolutely devoted to one another. They were separated as children after the death of their mother. The father sent Dorothy off, and a good decade goes by, and then they're reunited, and they were all in all to one another, up until anyway the time that Wordsworth met his wife, Mary Hutchinson. And even after that, she lived with Wordsworth right up to the end and actually outlived him.
Is least said best when it comes to the latter part in your mind? Did he become, you know, very much right-wing and conservative? And is that just what often happens when people get older, particularly when they're very radical when they're young?
Well, there are plenty of right-wing conservative writers who write brilliant art without stopping being right-wing or conservative. It's that something in him died. And Bate tries to cover this at some length. I think Seamus Heaney put it best when he said that Wordsworth, the problem with the elder Wordsworth is that he went from being an individual to an institution. He became rather pompous, rather self-satisfied, but I think that happened as a result of a number of very difficult things, perhaps most of all the death of two of his children, young Catherine and Tommy, in 1812. Something in him broke, and the fight went out of him. But, you know, he had achieved so much up to that. I think we have to give him credit for what he did achieve. And, you know, Bate actually wonders aloud rather impishly whether it might have been better for Wordsworth if he had died at the same age of Byron, at the age of 37. His reputation would be so much stronger. I don't know if I'd go quite so far. But Wordsworth, I mean, he survived. He really had a difficult life in so many ways. He survived, and by his own lights, he kept himself sane. I mean, the losses he experienced went very, very deep indeed. And in the end, he, as I say, the fight went out of him, and he reconciled himself more and more to the establishment. But in a way, what was going on there when he became a kind of an old, a rather pompous Tory, is he was doing the same thing in a different form that he'd always done, even as a young man. He was in denial about modernity, about the fact that the world was changing so much. So he aligned himself with the landowning class, which he saw as a better guarantor of the old ways of life. I mean, he once said that the perfect republic for him would be a republic of shepherds and agriculturalists. And he looked to the cantons of Switzerland as the ideal country. And what happened in France just really changed his whole view of the world.
What about the Jonathan Bate book then, Radical Wordsworth, The Poet Who Changed the World? Who is it for? What's the tone here? How academic is it? How accessible is it?
Well, Bate is best known as a Shakespeare scholar, and he's a past master at writing really well-researched but utterly accessible and engaging scholarly work. So this is a book that it's pitched at undergraduate students, but also anyone who just wants to get excited about Wordsworth and maybe had a bad experience at school with the much maligned daffodils.
Right. Well, maybe we should finish up then with one of his poems. In fact, it was broadcast on BBC, the Newsnight programme on the 22nd of March 2017, the day of the Westminster terror attacks. 56 people dead, 50 people injured. And again, I suppose it gives us a real sense of just how political Wordsworth's work can be viewed as well. The reader here is Tom Hollander.
Composed upon Westminster Bridge by William Wordsworth. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning, silent, bare. Ships, towers, domes, theatres, and temples lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did sun more beautifully steep in his first splendour valley, rock, or hill. Ne'er saw I, never felt a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still.
Tom Hollander there reading William Wordsworth's poem Composed Upon Westminster Bridge, and that from Newsnight on the night of the 22nd of March 2017. Before that you heard Dara Downes speaking to me about the book Radical Wordsworth, The Poet Who Changed the World by Jonathan Bate. It's published by William Collins. Tonight's programme will be podcast tomorrow afternoon, and that means that you can get all previous programmes if you want to take a look, both on the RTE website, rte.ie/radio1/arena, or indeed wherever you usually get your podcasts. You can listen to an entire programme, or on the website you'll also have a chance to listen to separate episodes. So please do take a look. There's, I think, lots of interesting stuff there for you to listen to in the coming days and weeks. It's rare that you can point to a single movie as being the originator of an entire genre. But 50 years ago, when a movie called Airport hit the screens, it became not just a smash hit at the box office, but initiated a string of imitators that was to last for a decade and more. Simon Marr and Cara O'Doherty have been looking back at that 1970 movie Airport, the disaster movie genre in general that Airport could be said to have kick-started. Cara, You actually went right back to the beginning of the 20th century and took a look at how disaster movies grew from 1903 right through to Airport really being the pinnacle of them all.
I did. I got a little bit carried away with this one. And yeah, I went right back to actually 1901, which was one of the first ever disaster. 1901, one of the very first ever disaster movies. It was called Fire. It lasted 4.5 minutes. And it was about a local fire station going to the rescue of a house fire. So it was absolutely groundbreaking at the time. People had never seen anything like it. And that is really where the disaster world begins.
And I thought then that weather movies and climate movies, we'd have to wait until right up to recent times to get those. But in the 20s and 30s, the weather was a major part of a lot of disaster movies.
The weather was the key. Noah's Ark, filmed in 1928, they used so much water that it said that three extras died. It's one of those great Hollywood legends. In the deluge in 1933, they destroyed New York. And it's amazing to watch these almost sort of Lego versions of New York City crumble to tiny shreds. And then there was the last days of Pompeii in 1935. I mean, they really, really went big on weather and weather-related disasters in those early days.
And now, obviously, things went a little bit quiet for during the war. I suppose there was enough of a disaster there without giving us other things in movies. And the 50s saw the paranoia of invasions from space that I think we can all kind of remember. Let me go to you at this point, Simon. What was it in the 70s then that made Airport be so different from what we had seen in the previous half century, three quarters of a century, in fact?
Well, what they were looking for, Sean, is they were searching for stories of regular Joes doing amazing things. And that's what they had. And they'd come up with this idea that they should do that. And there was two chaps. There was a guy called Ross Hunter, who was big into this, and another guy called Irwin Allen. And they decided that there's loads to be done here. But the first thing that they discovered, and it had been tried on several occasions in the 50s and 60s to try and make it work, but they eventually worked out that to have ordinary Joes excelling, you had to have huge Joes. So you had to go and you had to get Charlton Heston, you had to get Burt Lancaster, you had to get Dean Martin, you had to bring them all in for these.
And there was the novel previous to that. I'm saying Aldous Huxley, but I think I'm wrong when I'm saying that.
Arthur Haley, who's the guy who brought his hotel, among other things, had written the book Airport, and he had come up with this great idea. His idea all of the time was, he said himself that he was more of a soap opera sort of a writer, as in there happened to be airplanes involved with this, but it could just as easily be a bus or a train or an office building. It was all about the stories and intertwining all of the stories, and that's what you were looking for. And he said the big, big thing that Ross Hunter and Irwin Allen went looking for when they were coming up with ideas for movies and the Airport trilogy, or four movies as it eventually turned out to be, was that you had to have peril. People needed to feel that there was danger. So you had to have danger as well as romance and ball games in order for these movies to work.
Well, let's listen to a clip from Airport 1970. The basic premise here was that there was a suicide bomber on board, which, when you think back to 1970, that might have seemed like an outrageous type of peril. Sadly, as we know, it became all too real in more recent times. Here we'll hear Burt Lancaster as the airport manager in Lincoln International Airport in Chicago. A guy called George Kennedy, who's the George Kennedy playing a guy called Petroni, who's the chief mechanic, and Gene Seberg is in here as well, playing Terry Livingston, who's customer relations for the Airp line, and also there's a little bit of romance between herself and Bart.
Is there any chance that the plane could stand the explosion?
Well, we got one break. He's not sitting in an aisle seat. So first, it'll blow out a hunk of the fuselage right here.
And what kind of structural damage would that cause?
Luckily, there's nothing but skin on the sides. All the control cables run along here, so it's not too big a hole. She might still fly. But the sudden decompression at 30,000 feet is something you gotta see to believe.
He'll get sucked out, won't he?
Think so with anybody sitting next to him. Until that pressure equalizes, everything within 20 feet of him that's not nailed down or strapped in is gonna get sucked right out that hole.
Is it that powerful? Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. When I was a mechanic in the Air Force, I was being transferred on a Matz plane. At 20,000 feet, one of the windows shattered. The guy sitting next to it was about 170 pounds. He went through that little space like a hunk of hamburger going down a disposal. And right after him, coats, pillows, blankets, cups, saucers.
Takes about 3 seconds, doesn't it?
Three, four, five. Depends on the size of the hole. Everything fogs up just like that. And then watch out. That altitude, you can't breathe. So unless they get on oxygen in 45 seconds, it's goodbye.
And just in case you didn't know, it was a disaster. There's the music to help you along with your emotions. Burt Lancaster, George Kennedy and Gene Seberg in that scene from Airport 1970. Cara O'Doherty and Simon Mart speaking to me about this evening. Simon, how good a movie was it? Was it, you know, it was easy to parody it, as we'll talk about later, but how good was it as a disaster movie?
You know, I think as a story, it was great. You know, like these movies, they went on a budget of about 10 million quid. So they'd come along and they decided that they had a little few quid to play on special effects, but not a massive amount that they had. So they really still had to focus on story. So there was a lot, and probably a lot of the resurrections of disaster movies have fallen down on that basis, that they spent all the money on special effects and never worried about a story. But Arthur Haley was all about this idea that it had to be a good story. And the story in Airport 70, and indeed in its sequel, which is Airport 75, which is of course released in Airport in 1974, the stories were actually, corny and all as they were compelling stories.
And did it last? I think there were four airport films in total, Cara. When did it go all wrong, or did it survive for the four movies?
It definitely went all wrong by the last one, which was Airport 1979 Concorde. So they had upgraded from the old Boeings to a Concorde. I have to admit, I tried to find a copy to watch again. It's been years since I've seen it and I couldn't find it. But I believe it, Simon, did you get your hands on it?
I did indeed. I managed to actually find a copy on DVD that was knocking around the house, and I put it on and sat and watched it with a mixture of horror and fascination to see what it was, because it really was. And it was a great thing that they did, because Airport 70 and Airport 79, the Concorde, bookended the entire world of disaster movies so well. And you thought, there's the pinnacle, and then, yeah, here's the time when it's time to say goodbye.
But there was a few movies that came in between, which I know that for you, Towering Inferno 1974, slap bang in the middle of all of that, Cara, I think this is the one that really stands out for you.
Oh, it does. I mean, it has an amazing cast. Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, William Holden, Faye Dunaway, and even Fred Astaire, who was nominated for an Oscar. So you first off, you get have the two of the coolest actors of all time. It's set in a giant building called the Glass Tower. It's the world's tallest building. We already know somebody says something's the world's tallest, there's obviously going to be a problem. There's smoke on one floor. It turns out the building isn't as safe as they thought, and it turns into a raging inferno. Steve McQueen and Paul Newman have to figure out how to come to the rescue. But it really holds up in that it was very relevant to its time, whereas sometimes the others had more of a kind of a cheesy approach. They went for a much more kind of straight, realistic, kind of hardened approach, if you can say realistic when you're talking about disaster movies. But they just had that more sense of kind of grounded in reality.
Well, let's hear a clip featuring both McQueen and Paul Newman. You'll also hear William Holden in here and Richard Chamberlain. Holden playing the part of the building owner, Chamberlain playing the part of Simmons, whose compromising on the electrical specification may have led to the fire.
Forward command, go ahead.
Motion on 81! Fire headed toward elevator first! Three more crews up here, fast!
All right, they need a relief on 81. Hit it.
They're on the way.
John, you better call Duncan. Tell him to stop those people in the tower room from using that express elevator, or somebody's going to get killed. Okay, Kathy. Ring in a third alarm. I want some rescue squads here, and I also want choppers. We may need them. We're going to get those people down. All right, come on, fire. I'll be on 81.
All right.
Fire's moving toward the main shaft. Use the scenic elevator. Don't overload it.
Okay, Doug. I don't like the way you talk to me.
You drunk?
Not yet.
Well, then get out of my way.
You didn't talk like this 2 years ago, did you? Running over budget and out of money? Did you ask me then how I could shave $2 million off our electrical costs?
Shut up and help me with these people.
And let me ask you, my dear father.
Excuse me.
Am I the only subcontractor you encouraged to cut corners?
Excuse me?
Where did you save the other $4 million in Doug's original budget?
There we go. William Holden, Richard Chamberlain, Steve McQueen and Paul Newman in a clip there from Towering Inferno. Simon Marr and Carol Doherty speaking to me about how Airport 1970, in fact, spawned a whole raft of disaster movies during the 1970s. I skipped over Poseidon Adventure perhaps a little bit cruelly, Simon, but it kind of struck me, this always struck me, that they were trying to cash in on the success of Airport 70, but instead of having it in an airplane, let's put them on a ship and tell the same story in a slightly different way.
Well, there is a remarkable similarity between an awful lot of these movies, and even later on in the airports, I think Airport 77 kind of works its way back because it's a plane that sinks on this occasion. But the Poseidon Adventure is great. They end up, you know, the stock assembly of various characters, they're there, it's New Year's Eve, a huge tidal wave comes along, blows the ship over, ship ends up upside down, everybody's in trouble. What's interesting about this one is that an awful lot of people are dead, and are dead very, very early in this, whereas when you go back to Airport 70, I think it's just the suicide bomber is the only person who dies over the movie. But they've got Gene Hackman, and Gene Hackman is going to look after them, and he's decided he's going to be the man who's going to rescue them by leading them up the upside down ship and out to the hull to their ultimate rescue.
Well, let's hear how he does that in this clip.
All right. Rocco?
Yeah.
Bring him down this way.
All right, everybody down this way. Come on, baby.
Oh, this is a bunch of crap. We're sinking and nothing's going to keep us from drowning.
Keep moving.
It's right, Mrs. Rocco. There are air pockets all over this ship.
Air pockets?
Yes. Just because that deck flooded doesn't mean this one will.
No. How long will we stay afloat?
Long enough.
The Andrea Doria stayed afloat 10 hours before she sank.
You see, Nadia, everything is going to be all right. We got a long time to go.
Come on, keep moving.
This duct leads to a vertical air shaft.
Through that little hole?
This little hole, as you call it, is going to get us out of here and up to Broadway. We've climbed four decks so far. We've got two more to go. This is the only way out.
But you expect a person to fit through there?
Mrs. Rosen, you're going to crawl right through there. Believe me.
She has this illusion, always thinking she's too fast.
Mr. Rogo, will you follow me?
Yeah, I figured. It's me again, huh?
Why?
Because when we get to the other end of this duct, it's going to take both of us to help the others up.
Mr. Martin?
Yes, sir?
You follow up the rear. Make sure everybody's accounted for.
Oh, okay, Reverend.
I'm going next. So if old fat ass gets stuck in there, I will be caught behind her.
Stella Stevens, the final voice you heard there as Linda Rogo, and Shelley Winters, Jack Albertson playing the beautifully in love Belle and Manny Rosen. You also heard the voices in there of Pamela Sue Martin and the little boy Eric Shea playing the little boy Robin Shelby. And we'll come back to how little boys feature in different disaster movies later on. I'm wary about joking too much about the Andromeda strain, but because we're into the world, in some ways, I think you would argue, Cara, this is more like science fiction rather than a disaster movie clean and straight.
Yeah, I mean, sort of to go with the traditional sense, it's things that could happen, even if they are exaggerated, like deadly storms, wildfires, or disturbed people who create things. But the Andromeda strain is based on an alien virus being unleashed on Earth, and timing wise, possibly not something that people want to see. The virus is quite nasty, and people they don't do too well when they get it. So it certainly spawned an entirely different type of disaster genre, like the zombie films, post-apocalyptic things. So it certainly, definitely has its place in cinematic history for those reasons.
Things went a little bit quiet in the 1980s, I would say largely because of Airplane, which I'm going to finish up with. But when did we come back to the disaster movie genre later on in time then? When did that happen, Cara?
So the 1990s saw a return, and the early 2000s. Now, these ones were all very, very based on action, not so much plot. We had Twister with Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton versus a tornado. Pierce Brosnan appeared in Dante's Peak about a volcano in 1997. In that same year, Tommy Lee Jones faced off against a volcano. Not long afterwards, we had Deep Impact, where there was comets coming for the Earth. So there's a whole barrage of kind of mid-90s kind of culminating in my guilty pleasure is Armageddon from 1998, with Liv Tyler, Ben Affleck versus an asteroid. Aerosmith singing their big song. It's never going to win any awards, but it holds a place in my heart, and I can't lie.
And in terms of the nearer contemporary disaster movies, what stands out for you, Simon?
Probably the biggest, the most high profile. They did a couple of remakes of things. So the Poseidon Adventure, funny enough, got two remakes. A TV movie with Steve Guttenberg in it, which wasn't something that was to be talked about ever again. And then a huge budget version in 2006 with Kurt Russell and Josh Lucas, which again was great on action, high on action, but really, really terrible film. But probably the biggest, most recent one was Dwayne Johnson's San Andreas. So again, San Andreas Fault, big earthquake movie. Again, ultra, ultra cheesy, but it definitely had its charm. Something that was at least worth watching.
All right, I've been holding off on it. Airplane then, 1980s. It really did. It took all the airport movies and made an absolute fool out of all four of them. Did it kind of sound the death knell for the disaster movie in some ways, Simon?
You know, I think the disaster movie was probably on the way out. Like, you know, it got to the point where they got through the big ones, the big budget, and he was talking about the people who were still hanging on. He had the likes of Irwin Allen, who had been behind the Poseidon Adventure and the Towering Inferno. But he was still dragging movies in at that stage. He did ones that had exclamation marks in them all of the time. You had to see it. Flood, Fire, and Outrage was one of them. But he had been baffled by George Lucas. He said, there's no way that this sci-fi thing will take off again, because there's no love story and there's no action to go on. So then when it got to the point where Airplane came out, I think he honestly thought people take these things very, very seriously, and they're going to take the disaster movie seriously, and it can't be parodied. But when Airplane it was, and it was done brilliantly.
It was, certainly was. And I'll finish up with that clip from Airplane! Exclamation mark. Both of the pilots on the plane have fallen sick. There's nobody left to fly the plane. The flight stewardess, wonderfully named Randy, is played by Lorna Patterson. She approaches Ted Stryker, played by Robert Hayes, and he's the only person with flying experience on board. They go to the cockpit where they meet Dr. Rumack, played by none other than Leslie Nielsen.
Excuse me, sir. There's been a little problem in the cockpit.
The cockpit? What is it?
It's the little room in the front of the plane where the pilots sit. But that's not important right now. You see, the first officer is ill, and the captain needs someone to help him with the radio. Do you know anything about planes?
Well, I flew in the war, but that was years ago. I wouldn't know anything about it.
Would you go up, please?
The stewardess said... Both pilots.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Doctor, I've checked everyone. Mr. Stryker's the only one.
What flying experience have you had?
Well, I flew single-engine fighters in the Air Force, but this plane has four engines. It's an entirely different kind of flying, altogether.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.
Besides, I haven't touched any kind of plane in 6 years.
Mr. Stryker, I know nothing about flying, but there's one thing I do know. You're the only one on this plane who can possibly fly it. You're the only chance we've got.
Oh, it's always great to have a piece of music to help you along with what you should be feeling. Airplane! Exclamation mark, featuring Lorna Patterson, Robert Hayes and Leslie Nielsen. And of course, Airplane! Went on to spawn a whole generation of parody movies in itself. Simon Marr and Cara O'Doherty talked to me about disaster movies earlier on there. That's our lot for this evening here on Arena. Paula Shields was the researcher. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.